I'm speaking to you from Edinburgh, Scotland. We've set up our microphone here at the world-famous Achterlony Scotch Whiskey Distillery. Now, standing beside me, a man with a most unusual occupation. Would you step up to our microphone, sir, please?
Is anyone here? How do you
do, sir?
But would I...
How do you do, sir?
How do you do?
I understand that you are a Scotch whiskey taster.
That is correct. I am not a whiskey taster who is Scotch. I am English, actually.
Oh, I see.
But I taste whiskey that is Scotch. You could say I'm an English Scotch whiskey taster.
Well, that is a most unusual occupation.
I beg your pardon.
I said it's an unusual occupation.
Oh, yes, I suppose so. I've never really thought about it.
Well, could you tell us, sir, how do you go about your job?
Well, normal business hours. I drive to work every morning at 9.
Uh-huh.
Somebody drives me back home at 5.
Well, what happens in between? What happens in between?
I sometimes wonder. Oh, you mean, what do I do?
Yes, what do you do? That's right.
I do my whiskey tasting.
Ah, I see.
You see all these glasses here?
Mm-hmm.
They're filled with scotch, and I keep tasting them to see if they're up to our standard.
You mean this goes on all day?
Certainly.
Without a break?
Of course not. We have a break every so often. Go next door to the pub for a quick one.
Well, I will say this, sir. I will say this. You don't seem to look any the worse for the constant daily drinking you've been doing.
Oh, thank you.
No, you look very distinguished with your snow-white hair, your clipped white mustache and goatee. Yes. If I may say so, yes? you look very much like my grandfather.
Oh, yeah. Very kind.
Tell us, sir, how old are you?
I'm 23.
Oh.
Well, cheers, eh?
With me now, ladies and gentlemen, one of the most sensational acts in show business, the fabulous Professor Bernardi and his talking dog. May I say welcome.
Nice to be here, Frank.
I suppose you've been keeping very busy?
Oh, yes. We did 3 weeks at the Palladium in London and the Lido and Paris, and we just flew in by jet to open at the Copa.
Well, you should get great audiences.
Well, we hope so.
No, don't worry about it. Everybody wants to see Professor Bernardi and his talking dog.
You're very kind.
And now let's have a word with Professor Bernardi. Professor, that's an amazing have there.
Hey, all right.
All right, well, you should be proud to own such a brilliant animal.
He's a loudmouth.
Professor,
He's a loudmouth. I said this and I say it again, a loudmouth. It's my fault, though. I taught him to talk and I have created a canine Frankenstein.
Well, Professor, you mean to say he's using his talent for, sinister purposes?
It's terrible.
Well, I don't understand.
Well, you know what he does, this talking dog?
Well, what?
Other dogs chase cats.
Uh-huh.
Not him. No, he hides behind a tree and he says, "Here, kitty, kitty, here, kitty, kitty." Oh. When the innocent cat comes over, wham, bam, ugh, it's a himmel, it's murder.
Well, that's unsportsmanlike.
And at night, I go out of the hotel room for a paper.
Uh-huh.
He jumps on the phone and he calls room service, orders 3 steaks, a broccoli with Hollandaise sauce, and... My food bill last week was $112.
Oh, yeah.
I eat in a drugstore.
Oh, well, just a minute. Professor, you are his master, aren't you? Why don't you discipline him?
If I raise a hand, he phones the SPCA.
Oh.
And the lies he tells them.
Well, I don't understand this, Professor. Look, if you're so unhappy, why don't you split up?
Oh, no.
Well, just a minute. You could do a comedy act by yourself.
No.
Oh, wait a minute, Professor. I have seen you work many times, and you are very funny without the dog.
It wouldn't work.
Well, why not?
You see, he writes the material.
Oh. This is Frank Schuster reporting to you from London, where we've set up our microphone to interview Scotland Yard's man of mystery, the incredible Inspector Wayne.
How do you do?
Inspector, the Commissioner of Scotland Yard has told me that you are absolutely fantastic.
No, come now. We mustn't go overboard, you know?
No, you are considered the world's greatest undercover agent and a master of disguise.
Now, it's just my work, doing a job, that's all.
Well, could you give us an example of some of these disguises you've assumed?
All right. For instance, I had to go to France on a case.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly, I assumed these French disguise, and I became a complete Frenchman. You see, it was very simple.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's nothing. Huh? Following week, I found it necessary to disguise myself as an Austrian scientist. And, well, with a little makeup, I went to Vienna, and I broke up an entire espionage ring single-handed. It was wunderbar, that's
well,
what it was.
Tell me, Inspector, did you ever go behind the Iron Curtain?
My dear Tovarich, already three times this year been in Moscow and rescued three political prisoners.
That's marvelous, Inspector.
That's really nothing, just a knack, you know?
Well, what about the Far East? Did you ever go to the Far East?
Oh, yes, I spent 5 years on break up big black market gang in Tokyo. Ah, so, yes.
Really, Inspector, you know, you should have been on the stage.
Oh, you're very kind.
Well, tell me another thing. Have you ever been unsuccessful and failed in a case?
Oh, only once, actually, in America. Huh? I was disguised as a Southern colonel, see?
Hmm?
And I trailed this chap to the shower room of the YMCA. Naturally, I lost him because I couldn't go in.
But you couldn't go in?
No.
Well, why not?
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. You didn't realize. That's my greatest disguise. I'm a woman.
Oh. Hello, this is Frank Schuster. Beside me is just Sigmund Wayne. Dr. Wayne is the author of that runaway bestseller, How to Have a Fantastic Memory. Welcome, Dr. Wayne.
Thank you, Mr.
Schuster.
Schuster.
Doctor, in your book, How to Have a Fantastic Memory, mm-hmm. you have described a set of simple rules with which anyone can train himself to have a fantastic memory.
That is correct, Mr.
Schuster.
Schuster, yes.
Could you tell our radio audience something about these rules?
What rules?
The rules in your book.
Buck?
How to Have a Fantastic Memory.
Oh, yes. I'd be more than happy to, Mr.
Schuster.
Schuster.
Yes.
I think I can explain it very easily. Many people have difficulty remembering things because they have no system of remembering.
I see.
Now, in the first chapter of my book, How to Have a Fantastic
Memory.
Memory, yes. That's of association. In other words, to help you remember something, you associate it with something else, and it remains indelibly in your mind.
Well, could you give us an example?
Of what?
Of the system.
What system?
The system of association that helps you remember, as described in your book.
Book?
How to Have a Fantastic Memory.
Yes, of course, yes. Association.
Association.
Very simple, yes. When I have difficulty remembering anything, I associate it with something else, you see, and I never forget it. For instance, take your name.
Schuster.
Yeah, I have had a little trouble with it. Eh?
Yes, you have. You have, Doctor.
But I'll never have trouble with it again because of my system.
Yeah, your system.
Yeah, your name is?
Schuster.
Right. Now, using my system, I rhyme it with rooster.
Rooster.
You get it? Rooster, Schuster.
Oh.
Now, I lock that in my mind. Rooster, Schuster, rooster, Schuster.
I see.
I think of that handsome bird, and I never forget.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Wayne.
You're welcome, Mr. Peacock.
Good afternoon. We have with us one of the great men of our time, a living legend, the intrepid African explorer, Sir Trevor Beagleman. Welcome, Sir Trevor.
How do you do? Nice to be here.
Sir Trevor, you have just returned from 10 years in Africa.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I have spent the last 10 years living among the pygmies of Tanganyika.
And how did you find the pygmies?
It was terribly difficult. You see, they're so short. In the grass.
No, I don't.
These little fellows.
Sir Trevor, please. I didn't mean that.
I mean,
how'd you get along with them?
Oh, yes, I see. Well, charming, delightful people. They took me in as a brother.
Really?
Yes, they actually gave me a native name, rather touching, I thought. They called me Maboto Kubazinga Lakunga.
And what does that mean?
A rhinoceros face.
Oh.
Actually, it's quite a compliment. See, the pygmies consider the rhinoceros sacred.
Oh, I see.
They call my wife Tohumbalabonga Kadunga Bubu.
And what does that mean?
I'll tell you after the show.
Oh, all right, I see.
Actually, I agree with them. She's a beast, you know. At least she was a beast.
Well, what brings
gone,
you...
Gone, you know.
Oh,
they
too bad.
I'm
sorry about
yes.
that. Well, what brings you here to our city, Sir Trevor?
Actually, I'm delivering a series of lectures on the pygmy and his way of life, and I shall be showing things like this blowpipe and the poison dart.
Oh, I've heard a lot of these poison darts. Is that a real one?
Oh, yes.
An authentic poison dart?
Oh, most dangerous weapon in Africa, you see. You place the blowpipe in your mouth. That, right?
Uh-huh.
And one puff and the poison dart is on its way, like this. You see, it's simple. I say, Mr. Oh, dear. Right between the eyes. Bad luck, old man. Well, this is Sir Trevor Beagleman returning you to the studio.
We've set up our microphone in a deserted alley somewhere in New York. And with us is one of the distinguished criminals of our time, public enemy number 3, Mad Dog Middlecoff. Hello there, Mad Dog.
Hi.
Mad Dog, the reason we're here to interview you is because there's a rumor around town that you are planning to give yourself up.
Yeah, that is correct. I'm toying with the idea, but I ain't decided how I'm going to do it.
Well, what do you mean, how?
You must have read about them criminals that surrendered a few months ago. One of them surrendered to the Daily Mirror, another one surrendered to the Daily News.
Oh, yes, of course. Everybody's read that.
Yeah, well, it's okay for them guys, but for a guy with my standing, I'm number 3.
Yes, we know you're number 3.
I could never surrender to a newspaper.
You could never surrender to a newspaper?
It would have to be a magazine, at least.
You would surrender to a magazine?
Well, not just any magazine. It'd have to be a prestige magazine, you know, like the Saturday Review of Literature or the Atlantic Monthly, the Kenyon Review, you know.
Oh, well, I see. But some criminals have surrendered to Walter Winchell, you know.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking Walter, you know. But if I'm going to surrender, it would have to be to Clifton Fadiman or Louis Cronenberger, or Gilbert Seldes, John Mason Brown. In a pinch, Bennett Cerf, but that's as far as I'd go.
Well, tell me, is there a feeling in the underworld that surrendering to a daily paper is déclassé?
Oh, there's a feeling that you can't go out and just surrender to any paper. I mean, there's the question of editorial policy, of political orientation.
Of course,
a guy's been a Democrat all his life, he's certainly not going to surrender to a Republican newspaper.
Well,
little gauche, you know.
Yes, I suppose so. Well, have you ever thought of surrendering to some other medium?
What do you mean?
Well, there's radio, for instance, and there's television, and, of course, there's the record business.
Well, no, radio and television's out of the question, because if I go on, you see, the FBI can insist on equal time. That's the regulation.
That's true, yes. Well, that leaves the record business.
The record business? Are you kidding? How do you think I got to be public enemy number 3?
Thank you very much.
It's okay.
I'm speaking to you from our model kitchen, where we have another distinguished guest with us, one of the leading American authorities on nutrition, Dr. George Detweiler.
Thank you, and hello, fans of good diets.
Dr. Detweiler,
mm-hmm.
In your recent book, Eat Whipped Cream and Live Longer,
yes,
you introduced to America a startling new concept in dieting.
Well, that is correct. I believe all the women's magazines are calling it the whipped cream diet.
Yes, and that's what I'd like to discuss with
mm-hmm.
you. Now, how exactly does your whipped cream diet work?
Very simply, I recommend whipped cream in generous portions at every meal. And just before bedtime, a little more whipped cream, you know, snacks.
Oh, yes. Well, in other words, you mean lots of desserts?
Oh, not necessarily. I believe in putting whipped cream on all foods.
Putting whipped cream on all foods?
Right, right.
You mean like, well, like sardines?
Great favorite of mine.
Really?
Nothing like sardines and whipped cream. Oh, another favorite is whipped cream in soup.
Whipped cream in soup?
I can see your mouth watering.
Well,
and of course, whipped cream on a thick slice of rare roast beef, well, you can't beat it.
And you say that this diet works?
Certainly. Look at me. I've been on it for 5 months, and how do I look to you?
Well, I must admit, you look very slim and very fit.
I weighed myself this morning, 5'10", and I weigh 160 pounds.
That is remarkable. What did you weigh before you started this diet?
83 pounds. I was a mess. Oh, I was sick.
Thank you very much, Dr. Detweiler.
All right.
We've set up our microphone in the office of the president of one of America's top record companies, Bafo Records. How are you, sir?
Welcome to the Bafo label, sir.
Your company, sir, is responsible for some of the top record albums of today.
That's right. You can see them mounted on the wall behind me. There's the number one LP of the nation, The Funny Humor of Robert Newnose.
Oh, yes, very good album.
And there's another great comedy album, The Thin Edge of Irving Wedge. Here's one. Saul Mortz laughs at our way of life. That's his 8th album of President Kennedy jokes. And it's a rouser.
He certainly plays hob with our middle-class foibles.
And, of course, another great album, The Sick Humor of Melvin Sick.
Oh, yes.
But one I'm particularly proud of is this new album, which I feel is a first. And an entirely new concept that will revolutionize the record industry.
Well, that's why I'm here, sir. The industry's buzzing with the news that you have something brand new up your sleeve. What exactly are you going to do?
It'll be a radical departure from the record business as we know it today, but, well, here it is. We are going to record music.
I beg your pardon?
Music. I know it sounds revolutionary, but I think the public would find a record with music on it. An interesting novelty.
But sir,
I know what you're going to say. The public won't accept the record unless someone is telling jokes on it and people are laughing. But I think that America is ready for records with music on them.
Well, lots of luck with it.
Thank you. And who knows, if it works, perhaps in a couple of years we'll gamble with vocalists. I don't see any reason why that fella in politics, what's his name, Frank Sinatra, why he shouldn't make records.
Standing beside me, ladies and gentlemen, is the latest visitor to New York. Welcome to Manhattan, Sheikh Ali Ben Alamem.
Greetings and blessings upon you all.
Sir, all America was fascinated to discover that the real purpose of your visit is to acquire some wives for your harem.
That is correct. I am holding auditions this afternoon at NOLA Studios at Broadway at 2 o'clock this afternoon. No triflers, please.
Well, I understand that altogether you have 375 wives.
375, 376. Who keeps count? The bookkeeper knows.
Oh. Well, that's certainly something. 375 wives.
It's not as pleasant as it sounds. It also means I have 375 mothers-in-law.
I never thought of that.
And other drawbacks.
Oh?
Did you ever walk into a bathroom and see 750 wet stockings hanging there?
Oh.
It's like a damp nylon jungle.
Well, sir, if you have 375 wives,
yes,
and you don't like it,
mm-hmm,
why would you want more?
Ah, my dear fellow, you do not understand the ways of my people. You see, the more wives you have, the more important you are. It is, prestige to have many wives.
I see.
In your country, you say a status symbol.
Oh, I see. Well, if we can help you at all with this broadcast, we'd be glad to.
Oh, well, anyone who would be interested in becoming a member of my harem, please send your name, measurements, and photograph to me, Sheikh Ali Ben Alamem.
By the way, Sheikh, your address. Where do you live?
Oh, where I have lived all my life, Hollywood, California.
Oh, thank you.
That's all right, baby.
Schuster speaking to you backstage at the Martin Kummer Theater on 48th Street and Broadway. That ovation you hear is for the man who has been hailed by critics as the greatest living English actor, Sir Cecil Cavendish. Currently appearing on Broadway with his own production of Hamlet, Sir Cecil is considered the most beautiful voice on the English-speaking stage. I'm going to try to interview him. Oh, Sir Cecil! Sir Cecil! How are you, Sir Cecil?
Thank you. I am all time in New York. Very good.
Sir Cecil, as the greatest living English actor, you are noted for your fine speech and diction.
I can say so. I wouldn't say my diction was any more brilliant than I had long to remember. All right, which is
Oh, come now, you're much too modest.
No, fast. No, it
came. Well, Sir Cecil, I suppose you have had a chance to see some of our Native American productions.
Oh, yes.
Well, what do you think of our method actors? You know, those American actors who belong to the naturalistic school of performing? Mm-hmm. Men like Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando?
Yes.
Well, actually, I can't say I'm the Marlon Brando. I think he has everything to cover his wife.
I beg your pardon?
Marlon Brando has everything to cover his wife.
I didn't quite make that out. Could you write that out for me?
Marlon Brando and me,
can I see that?
Yeah.
Marlon Brando has a tendency to garble his words.
Yeah.
Well, I see our time is up, Sir Cecil. Thank you very much.
Pardon?
I said thank you very much.
Speak up. Don't mumble. Here, write it out for me.
Oh, right here. Thank you very much.
Oh. You're welcome.
We have a very unusual visitor at our microphone today. Your name, sir?
If you don't mind, I'd rather not give my name.
Of course. But we can mention your occupation, which is why you are here. You are an international jewel thief.
That is correct. That is my profession, and I am proud of it.
Well, you international jewel thieves are considered the aristocrats of crime.
Well, we'd like to think that. I hope you don't think me a snob, but an international jewel thief is different.
Well, according to the movies, you always wear tails when you work. Is that true?
Well, the older fellas do, but we younger international jewel thieves prefer the dinner jacket. It's a little less pushy.
Oh, I see.
Same thing applies to our getaway cars.
You mean you don't use the powerful black limousine?
That's all right for the beer barons and the nouveaux, you know.
Oh, I see.
We prefer the quiet understatement of an English sports car. Simple, classic lines. Effective, but not showy.
I see. Well, what would your advice be to a young juvenile delinquent whose ambition is to become an international jewel thief?
That is a question I am often asked. First of all, to the young lad, I would say, follow my lad.
Yes.
Start in your own hometown. That's how I began, on the local level.
Local level, yes. I see.
Stealing rhinestones and costume jewelry in a rented tuxedo.
Oh.
Took time and practice. Then I went to a larger city, then still larger city, and finally the big time.
The south of France.
We call it the south of France.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Well, thank you, sir, for a very interesting interview, and now I see by our clock on the studio... Well, that's funny. It's gone.
Oh, sorry. Got carried away. Here it is. Got to keep the fingers nimble.
Thank you very much. Greetings from the home of jazz. I'm speaking to you from downtown San Francisco, where I've set up our microphone at that great jazz center, the Village Cesspool. Beside me, that great immortal of jazz, Pee Wee Pincus. Hello, Pee Wee. Hi, Pee Wee.
Hi, crazy, man, crazy.
Pee Wee, they tell me there are big things in store for you and your group.
That's right, man. Like, we're cutting out of here and going on like a world tour with the jazz concerts, Dad. We're like going to blow a message of peace and goodwill.
This is sort of peace through jazz, is that it?
You got it, Dad.
Well, I guess you're pretty excited about bringing your music to the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah, man. I was talking to Satchel Mouth the other day.
Satchel Mouth?
That's my wife.
Oh, I see.
I said to her, man.
Wait, you called her man?
And that's a compliment.
Oh.
I said, man, I can hardly wait to start that tour around the world.
I suppose you'll be flying.
Oh, yeah. I don't blow good when I'm sober.
I see.
It's a drag that way.
I mean, you'll be traveling by airplane.
Well, I ain't walking. That's for sure.
Well, where will you be playing?
In the troubled areas of the world, man. Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Las Vegas.
Well, how about Siam? I hear the king is a jazz fan.
Oh, yeah, like I love to play for them Siamese cats. I hear they're wild.
Well, Pee Wee, all of America, of course, wishes you good luck.
Crazy.
And when does this mission of peace and goodwill start?
As soon as my bass player and drummer get out of jail.
Oh, I see.
Nothing serious. Disturbing the peace, that's all.
Oh, thank you, Pee Wee Pink.
That's okay, man.
I'm speaking to you from the laboratory of Professor Burton K. Middlecoff, the inventor of the famous Middlecoff robot, considered the most fantastic of all mechanical men. Is it all right if we set up our microphone here, sir?
Oh, I'm awfully sorry. The professor won't be back until tomorrow.
Well, perhaps you could just fill us in exactly what's been happening here in this laboratory.
I'll try. This panel here...
Yes.
...is the master control for the Middlecoff mechanical men.
Well, they're robots, aren't they?
No, not exactly.
When you say
robots, you sort of conjure up the image of a metal figure, you know, out of a comic book.
Uh-huh.
What the professor has been producing is a mechanical man... A real-looking man of plastic foam rubber, transistorized controls that you would not be able to tell from a flesh-and-blood human being.
You mean the mechanical man is that real?
Real. You ought to see the mechanical woman.
Wow. You're kidding.
No, it's amazing. You wouldn't believe it.
Well, I wonder, could you show us one of these mechanical men or women?
Well, no, you'll have to wait till the professor gets back. They're still experimental, you see, and he's the one that operates.
Well, perhaps you could tell us, do they walk and talk?
Just as well as you do. They walk by transistorized power, and they talk by means of a small transistor-driven tape recorder producing a human voice.
Well, it's really fantastic. Thank you very much for showing us around, and I'll be back tomorrow to interview the professor.
Not at all. The pleasure was all mine. All mine. All mine. All mine. All mine. All mine. All mine.
Good evening. We've set up our Wayne and Schuster microphone in a jungle clearing near Nairobi, Africa. The gentleman you can hear humming in the background is the man I'm going to interview. He's about 6'8", and he's wearing a most colorful outfit. A huge, grotesque mask, feathers, and he's carrying a human skull on a stick. Excuse me, sir? Excuse me?
Yes?
I would like to talk to you.
Oh, yes?
I was describing to our listeners this colorful outfit you're wearing. Oh. You know, the huge mask with the feathers.
you like the skull on the stick,
too? Oh, yes, that's very interesting.
Thank you.
Now, could you tell us exactly what you do?
Well, certainly. I am a witch dentist.
Just a moment, sir. Excuse me, a witch dentist?
Yes.
Well, what's that?
Well, you know what a witch doctor is. Well, I'm a witch dentist.
I see. Well, that must be something new.
Africa's on the march, baby. This ain't like the old days.
Well, I see. I see. That's very interesting, yes.
You see, all of us witch dentists are helping in our simple native way to fight tooth decay.
Well, is it working?
Oh, yes. You don't know what a thrill it is to see some youngster run into your hut shouting, "Look, Batumba, no cavities."
Well, it's really a most remarkable occupation, and it's been fun talking to a real witch dentist.
Well, my pleasure. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got a patient.
You have a patient?
Yes, a very interesting. You bangy having trouble with his bite.
I see.
Well, arrivederci.
Good evening. I'm reporting to you from Transylvania. We've set up our microphone in a mysterious castle here to interview for the first time in history a real, honest-to-goodness vampire. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you. And may I say, welcome to Transylvania.
Sir, we're here to clear up a few things about vampires.
I'm very glad, because we have been getting a very bad press in America. And I am delighted to be able to offer our side of the story. Quiet, Boris! That's my youngest.
Your youngest?
Yes.
Well. First of all, we have seen many motion pictures with Bela Lugosi.
Aha.
And
I'm glad you mentioned that name. Bela Lugosi is not a vampire. He is an imposter.
Bela Lugosi is an imposter?
A Hungarian who has made a career out of pretending to be a vampire. He would faint at the sight of blood. And speaking of blood, how about a drink?
Well, no, thank you. Really, I wouldn't care for any. Sir. Well, Count, look, is there any resentment on the part of vampires because of the way Hollywood has portrayed them?
Well, naturally. Always. We are villainous, horrible creatures living in haunted castles, preying on innocent people. Why shouldn't Hollywood put us in a musical?
A musical?
In technical. In widescreen. With people singing and dancing and drinking. And speaking of drinking...
Oh, no, thank you, really.
It was a good year for blood, 1947.
I don't care for any blood at the moment. No, thank you.
I can't tempt you.
No, really.
My dear sir, we vampires are a fun-loving people. So, if we have a little idiosyncrasy here and there, hasn't everybody?
Well, I suppose so, yes.
In a free world, we can all be friends, right?
Yes, I guess so. So your message to the world is live and let live.
For the time being.
Well, yes. Thank you very much.
Before you go, how about a drink?
No, really, I don't want a drink.
How about a bite?
No, I wouldn't care for a bite.
Do you mind if I have one?
Well, no, not at all. Go ahead.
And now back to the studio.
I have with me a most interesting personality. Your name, please.
My name is Milton Fenwick.
Mr. Fenwick.
Yeah?
You are that gentleman from Brooklyn who bears an amazing resemblance to Nikita Khrushchev.
Yeah.
You could be his twin brother.
Well, I'm not. I'm Milton Fenwick, and I come from Brooklyn.
Well, has this amazing resemblance affected your life at all?
Are you kidding? The last few months have been murder. Murder, that's it. I lived here in New York all my life, and now because I look like Khrushchev, I can't even walk down the street.
Well, I'm sorry, but I must admit it's an uncanny resemblance.
Okay.
No, really, you are the same height. You're heavy set, and you're completely bald, just the same as Mr. Khrushchev.
I know. I'm afraid to look in the mirror. It frightens even me.
Well, could you tell us, sir, what exactly happens when you walk down the street?
Everything. They boo. Some people start singing the Star Spangled Banner. Yesterday, two communists came up and they hugged me. Oh, it's impossible.
Well, it seems to me that you could do something about your appearance.
Like what?
Well, you know, with makeup, there are things you could do.
I tried that the other day. I bought myself a black toupee, you know, like the actors wear.
Uh-huh.
And a big beard.
Yes.
See, and I put them on. And then I walked down the street.
Well, what happened?
People booed me. They sang the Star Spangled Banner. And two communists came out and then they hugged me.
Well, how come?
With the toupee and the beard, I look exactly like Fidel Castro.
Thank you, Mr. Fenwick.
Okay.
And now we have at our microphone a distinguished visitor from England.
How'd you know?
You are the Duke of Shrewsbury.
It's quite correct, old man. To be exact, I am the 11th Duke of Shrewsbury.
And I understand you are here on some sort of educational mission.
Actually, I'm here to right a wrong, as it were. It has to do with what you Americans call the sandwich. And how the sandwich got its name.
Well, I understand it was named after the man who invented it, the Earl of Sandwich.
Poppycock. Actually, the man who gave the Earl of Sandwich the idea was my ancestor, the 8th Duke of Shrewsbury, and consequently, it should be named after him.
You mean it should be called a Shrewsbury instead of a sandwich?
Exactly. Makes me positively livid to walk into a restaurant and hear people call Shrewsburys sandwiches.
Oh, I see.
Don't you think sandwiches are a rather disgusting name for a Shrewsbury?
Well, I really never thought about it.
I see. Hmm. Well, that's why I'm here. To visit every restaurant in America and make sure that justice is done.
Well, so far, how is your campaign going?
Not too well.
Oh?
Walked into a New York delegate today and ordered a salami Shrewsbury.
A salami Shrewsbury?
On rye, of course.
Yeah.
Waiter chap called me. I believe the expression was wise guy. And he threw me out.
Too
broke
bad.
My monocle and everything.
But you are going to keep on fighting.
Rather. We'll get their family name on the menu, by George. There'll be toasted and cheese Shrewsburys, salmon Shrewsburys, peanut butter and jelly Shrewsburys, hot beef Shrewsburys.
And you think you will be successful?
Why not? If my cousin made it, by George, so can I.
Your cousin?
The Earl of Worcestershire.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Your Grace. And now back to our studio.
Down with sandwiches, up with Shrewsbury!
With me at the microphone, a recent arrival from Paris, the distinguished French literary critic, member of the Academy, Monsieur Jean-Louis Desjardins.
Allô, America.
Monsieur Desjardins.
Oui, mon vieux.
Are you enjoying your visit here?
Yes, I'm having, how you say here, a ball.
Well, can you tell us exactly what you've been doing?
Well, certainement. I went to see that Broadway show, La Plume de ma tante. I saw a concert by Yves Montand, Maurice Chevalier, Edith Piaf, Simon Signoret.
Oh, yes.
Went to Las Vegas to see the Lido Review, visit the Renoir and Cézanne exhibit at the Art Gallery, In short, I have been soaking up American culture.
Well, monsieur, let's talk about something French.
Certainly.
Now, everybody's talking about this daring new novel that was just published in Paris.
You mean L'amour, l'amour, et encore l'amour.
That's right, that's the book.
That is quite a book, yeah.
Well, tell me, is it true that this shockingly frank novel was written by a 9-year-old girl?
No. She is at least 11.
11 years old?
Oui. As a matter of fact, a French novelist. She led a sheltered life until...
What does the reading public feel about this terribly young girl writing these brutally adult novels?
They are buying the books, like you say, the bestsellers.
Yes, but what about the critics, the responsible leaders of French literary
they
thought?
They don't mind.
They don't mind?
No.
Well, what about you, distinguished member of the French Academy of Letters?
Where?
Don't you object to these youngsters taking the spotlight away from the more mature writer?
What should I object? I'm only 14 myself.
Oh, well, merci.
Y'a pas de quoi, mon vieux.
Good afternoon. We've set up our microphone in the office of a man with a most unusual occupation. How are you, sir?
How do you do, sir?
Would you tell our audience exactly what your occupation is?
Certainly. I am a dog psychiatrist.
In other words, you are a psychiatrist who specializes in the problems of dogs.
Exactly, yes. You see, dogs come to me for help. Well, they don't come to me. They are brought.
Oh, well, yes, we understand that, of course.
Like people come to psychiatrists for help.
Well, this is very interesting, Doctor. Do you have a couch?
Certainly, but I don't let the dogs on it. They lie on a newspaper.
Oh.
The couch is for me.
Oh, I see.
I get tired, you know.
Oh, I understand, of course. Mm. Well, what kind of problems do dogs have?
Oh, you'd be surprised. I had a patient the other day, a dog.
Not a dog.
I cannot mention the dog's name. Ethics, you know.
Of course.
But this dog had a problem.
He was what they call a mad dog.
Please, don't use such expressions. Mad dog. Don't be medieval. He was a problem puppy.
I see. Well, what was his problem?
He was always chasing cats.
Oh, no, just a moment. That's not very abnormal. Most dogs chase cats.
And this was Mr. Katz.
Oh.
And Mrs. Katz was very upset.
Well, that's understandable. Yes, well, how did you settle the thing?
Well, after a number of consultations, I decided the dog could never be cured.
Mm-hmm.
So I told Mrs. Katz to send him away.
And did she?
Yes. Katz is now living in Miami, and she and the dog are still in Brooklyn.
Oh, well, thank you, Doctor.
How come I didn't get a laugh when I said Brooklyn?
This is a record, you see. We have no audience.
Oh, well, that's your problem. I just handle dogs.
Standing beside me at our microphone is an important personality from the underworld. Your name, sir?
If you don't mind, pal, I would prefer not to divulge my identity. Suffice it to say, I'm a named criminal.
Well, that's good enough. You asked to appear on this program.
Right.
Will you tell us why?
Certainly. It's in connection with that list of criminals they publish every year in Washington. You know.
Oh, you mean the 10 most wanted criminals in America?
Yeah, that's the one.
Well, what is your objection to this list?
I'm not on it.
You're not on it?
Yeah. You know what it means to a named crook like me to pick up a paper and read the list of the 10 most wanted criminals in America, and I'm not on it?
I guess it's not very good prestige-wise.
Are you kidding or something? Are you a nut? To you, that list may be nothing, but you're not that crook. It's the Academy Award. It's the Nobel Prize of Crime. It's like making the Dean's List, buddy.
Well, why is it that an important underworld figure like you has never made this list?
Ah, that's what I want to know. I'm not saying I should be number one or even two, but I'm at least number six. Yeah. And you want to know what I think?
What do you think?
It's fixed.
It's fixed?
I think the whole thing is crooked and it should be investigated, you know, like boxing and them other things.
Well, what are you saying?
I want a Senate subcommittee to investigate who exactly is picking the list of the 10 most wanted criminals in America and on what basis they make their selection.
Well, good luck to you, sir.
Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not a status seeker, but I'm a human being, see? And just like everybody else, I need to be wanted.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, buddy.
Well, With me at our microphone, the distinguished Austrian scientist, Professor Johann Weingartner.
How do you do?
Professor, there have been rumors in the scientific journals that you have made a definite breakthrough in your latest experiments.
Yeah, that is correct. As you know, I have been conducting some experiments on smoking.
Smoking, yes.
And after 2 years of exhaustive research, I have established a definite link between cigarettes and tobacco.
Well, that is quite a breakthrough, yes.
If you need any mice, I have a few left over.
Well, that's fine. Thank you
very much. For the kids, maybe.
No. Really. Now, we understand that you have also been doing some work on filters.
Oh, yeah. This company hired me to develop a new kind of filter for cigarettes.
Well, could you tell us how it's been going?
Well, I'm a scientist.
Yes, we know that.
I'm very cautious, conservative about making any wild claims, but I must confess, I feel very optimistic about this filter, which I am calling the Weingartner filter.
You think this is an effective filter?
100% effective.
100% effective?
Now, hear this. See?
Yes.
It's a cylinder of solid marble between yourself and the tobacco.
A cylinder of solid marble?
Yeah.
Well, just a moment, Professor. The smoke can't get through at all.
How's that for effective, eh?
Well, Professor, really, with a solid marble filter, all the smoker will do is keep lighting it. The cigarette will never stay lit.
Right.
He'll have to keep lighting it over and over and over again. Isn't that true?
That's right, yes.
Well, just a moment. This is ridiculous. Now, what company would be satisfied with a filter like that?
Oh, didn't I tell you? I'm working for a match company.
Oh.
Have you got a light?
Thank you, Professor.
Have you got another light?
Please, Professor.
Have you got another light?
Just a minute, Professor. Really.
Another light, please.
We've set up our microphone in the home of the man who was once called America's most notorious counterfeiter. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
You are now, of course, a retired counterfeiter, aren't you?
That's right. When the old hands start shaking a little bit, it's time to put away the pen before they put you away in the pen. That's a joke we retired counterfeiters always use.
That's very good.
Well, thank you kindly.
Tell me, how do you manage to keep busy now that you've retired?
Oh, I keep an eye out for any promising young counterfeiters, and I help them.
You are sort of an elder statesman of crime.
You could say that, yes.
Well, what do you think of the young counterfeiters on their way up?
I don't know. I don't want to sound like a crotchety old man, but the young counterfeiters of today are on the wrong track.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, it's just modern art cake. You know, abstracts and non-objective painting. Well, it's just killing them. Now, look at this $1 bill done by a young student.
George Washington has only one eye, and it's in the middle of his forehead.
Exactly. The kid's in a Picasso kick.
Mm.
How are you going to pass money like that?
That's ridiculous, yes.
Now, here, look at this $10 bill.
Let's see. Hamilton is wearing a tutu.
The guy admires Degas.
Oh.
She. And look at this $5.
Let's see. It's white with a black dot in it. Well, that's ridiculous. A white $5.
I told him, but he said I paint what I see. Did you ever see a square half dollar, eh?
Cubism?
Right.
Well, in one sentence, sir, what is your advice to young counterfeiters?
Boys, get out of the left bank and into the First National Bank.
Thank you.